previously on Popping Collars.
I love having more conversations about how we all have those light and dark parts of ourselves and our world, and how we wrestle with those pieces as opposed to kind of putting it on a figure per se.
That's our next Popping Collars right there. We got to talk about the devil in popular culture.
Because that's the dark part. Running with the devil.
Ministry with whatever constituency you work with, you know, or do you, how do you not, or how do you, you know, how do you talk about evil and things?
Exactly. I'm thinking like personal sort of experience stories here and stuff. And honestly, because it really gets played out in popular culture as, you know, as a right versus left. I mean, it very much is kind of like you've got this embodiment of good represented by God or whatever on this side, and then this embodiment of evil that seems to be just as powerful on the other side. And that's the way that popular culture seems to establish it. And I guess the question becomes, is that like, I think absolutely that informs people's ideas of what a devil figure is. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the last time, Betsy, when you talked about people laughing during that bit, mm-hmm. when they were getting baptized and stuff, I think that the connotation when it comes across, when you're kind of reading the liturgy, is basically, it sounds like you're asking people, do you believe in the boogeyman? Or, and like, are you gonna do everything in your power to stop the boogeyman from getting you, you know, or something? And mm-hmm. I think that there's something to saying that evil is a legitimate physical thing that exists in the world, and we're calling it Satan, you know, mm-hmm. or something. I think if people are hearing those verses differently, like, what did you guys grow up with as far as like understanding the like evil or the devil or Satan, or is it all the same thing, or are they all different things? Like, what did you guys, how did you experience it? As a burgeoning young Christian.
I grew up in the Episcopal Church, which basically I think means that we didn't talk about the devil. You know what I mean? Like, I do not remember ever talking about it. I don't remember, like, some of my evangelical friends were really told, like, to guard yourself against the devil or demons, too. You know, I don't know where they fit into the whole situation. Mm-hmm. But, like, I didn't get any of that.
So you didn't have a sense, like, did you even think that, like, a devil figure existed or anything?
I definitely don't think I was getting that from the church as much as if I did think about it. Like, as a kid, it would have been coming from pop culture more than the church. And, I mean, I remember, like, that age where you're very sensitive. When you feel bad, like, guilt will just consume you. Or when you think you've made a mistake. Or maybe that was just me, but, you know, I'd feel super guilty, like somehow I did something wrong. And that feels like it was kind of identified with evil. Like, you know, you could really screw up in a big moral way. But I don't remember, I mean, I don't remember ever talking about it, like, with my parents or hearing about it in church ever.
And Betsy, you grew up Episcopalian, right?
Yeah, so but I grew up in Alabama.
Was it the same experience for you?
But I grew up in Alabama, so you have a lot of, you know, kind of hellfire and brimstone in the general area around you. So, I mean, so the devil was more in songs at camp. You know, we've like the, you know, this little light of mine, don't let Satan blow it out. You know, I'm going to let
what?
It shine.
What? That one's verses?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a classic. Classic verse, you know. And if the devil doesn't like it, he can sit on attack. What? Sit on attack? Because I'm so happy. So very happy. I've got the love of Jesus in my heart. Oh, yeah. So Satan
is a... I hope these are public domain.
Sorry. Oh, God. I hope. But Satan is a character in the songs who's going to be really PO'd that you're a happy Christian. And we'll try... Might try to... But then, you know, it's in the songs, but then it's not talked... about as much. And the whole kind of Episcopal Church setting itself up as being a different thing. Like there was a church in, I believe it was in Auburn, and I had a t-shirt. It had like an old wood carving on the back of it of like people being, you know, stirred in pots by, you know, devil figures. And it said, if all you want from the church is hellfire and brimstone, then burn this t-shirt. And so that was kind of the statement of, we are different here. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, it's that, but I remember like I had a couple of nightmares about the devil, like as a figure, as a scary thing. I also had a couple of nightmares about the Incredible Hulk. So I can't really pull those things together, but I didn't think of something out there tempting me to do something, or that it was that anything I was doing was separate from my own, choice. Mm-hmm. And so, so the personal,
so there was no evil outside of you working against you and your choices.
No.
It
would be an inner, and flaws can be a severe word, but you know, that it's an inner weakness in you that then gives into making a poor choice, or, you know, wanting something that's quick and easy and, you know, may feel really good for a moment and then it doesn't, you know, the thing that has you talk about somebody behind their back or, you know, do things like that.
I think, for, you know, just thinking about this and trying to imagine myself as a little kid, I remember I went through a period, I was probably really little, where I would, like, cross myself compulsively before falling asleep. Not compulsively, like it was a disorder, but, like, if it felt like if I didn't do it, something bad might happen. So I don't think I had a sense of the devil, but I do think I had a sense of somehow falling out of favor with God. Which is so not our theology. I mean, that would not have been a message that I got from church, but I had a sense of like, if I don't do things right, then it's not like the devil will get me, but God won't have me. Maybe.
Right. Well, like the, you know, you drive over railroad tracks, you pick up your feet, you go by a cemetery, you hold your breath. I mean, those little things that you do and you're like, why did I do this? Why did I pick this up? You know, it's not like my parents taught it to me, right? You know, so... little superstitions about kind of keeping everything in control and in line.
Yeah,
I feel like a lot of times it's easier to sell superstition than it is to sell religion. Like, superstition is what people glom onto a lot of times. It's funny because I was behind someone in line at the grocery store one time, and they had only like a couple of items, not very much, right? And they ring up the sale, and the total comes out to $6.66. That's the total, right? And all of a sudden, like, this person's checking out, and they, like, start looking around. They're like, okay, well, let me get a pack of gum, too. And it's this idea that, like, well, I can't pay that bill. That's, like, the evil bill.
Well,
in
seminary, when I got to choose between the phone exchanges, one of them was 510-666, you know, da, 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 and I was like, I'm picking that one. So I picked that one. And then, like, I have a friend who is having surgery, and she's a big Duke, you know, Dukey, big Devils fan, and that morning, like, I'm at, like, either it was whatever number was my waiting number at getting a bagel or something. And so my ticket number was 666. And I'm like, it's a good sign because the Blue Devils and your surgery's going to go great and it's all good. You know, so, yes.
It's like embracing the number 13 or something.
Right. Like, I'm going to take back the night. We're going to, you know. So I was just reclaiming the poor number 6 with its two additional friends that gets a bad rap. So,
I guess my upbringing was kind of similar to yours, Betsy, in the sense that I grew up in North Carolina. So we're still talking like rural Southern, traditions and stuff. I very much though, I grew up kind of Congregationalist and then Presbyterian and then Episcopalian. So I very much thought that the devil, demons, all those things were totally real.
Yeah.
Had the sense of that growing up. Still do. I mean, you know, it's funny how like those things that you believe early on really shape like a lot of what your spirituality is. And so they're like, it took me a long time. I want to say I was probably a senior in college before I would even attempt to watch The Exorcist, right? And it's not because I was afraid of the movie or anything like that. In my mind, I was afraid that it was real. Like there was not that the story was real, but that there was something real about the possibility of being possessed and like losing control of yourself and your decisions and stuff to some kind of evil force acting within you. That wasn't you. That was something else. But I totally believed that when I was a kid. And it really shaped, I think, a lot of this, because you end up like second guessing yourself, right? And you're like, did I make that decision? Did I make that poor decision? Or did something sort of, you know, control me and make that decision? And I know I'm better than that somehow. So it couldn't have been me. It couldn't have been my responsibility. It had to be something else. I think that that's, in some ways, and this is going to sound really weird, I think that's a comfort to some Christians to say, it wasn't me that did it. It was something that happened through me that did it on my behalf.
It's like conspiracy theories. Like, it's easier for some people to believe a really complicated conspiracy theory. It's easier to accept that than to accept the random reality of people doing bad things. You know, like the 9/11 inside job thing. If you believe that, it's a very complicated system. And I think that some people would rather accept that than this idea that people bent on evil boarded an airplane and did something unimaginable. You know, they would rather, and I think it's the same thing. If you let yourself off the hook a little bit when you think that, you know, surely it's not me that did that bad thing. It had to have been something other than me, no matter how hard it is to arrive there intellectually.
Well, it's that embracing of the shadow, you know, embracing the part of you that wants, you know, that quick hit of feeling powerful, or that quick hit of feeling, you know, self-satisfied, or whatever that is, that, you know, that thing that comes from you when you put others down so that you feel better about yourself. And with teaching students, and particularly with younger students, I think I always would bring that, I wanted to bring that vulnerability to when I talked about mistakes that I had made personally, either in my childhood or, you know, just the other day or on the way to school when I said something, you know, in a tone I shouldn't have. And to have that piece be something that I could own in front of them, and then have them be able to own their stuff too. Because if we embrace that we're people that have free choice, and that we can treat the world and each other in the way that we choose to, and are we going to allow something to help us navigate that path, even though there are times when we step off it, there are still ways to get back on and to continue forward. And that having a more full view of who we are, that yin-yang, that there's dark and the light, and that they work together in some way.
So when you run into the devil or Satan or however it's written up in the Bible, which, I mean, they'll show up in our lectionary periodically. Certainly the temptation is going to show up in the lectionary, the mm-hmm. temptation of Jesus in the wilderness. I think the beginning of Job shows up sometimes, maybe. I'm not sure. I think it sets up Job at some point. Certainly the temptation in the garden, however you see the serpent, a lot of people see the serpent as a devil figure. So whenever you run into the devil in, scripture, how does your brain go about thinking, you know, if we're thinking in terms of, you know, it's all about you. It's you making good decisions. It's you making bad decisions. It's you trying to follow the call of God in your life. It's not some outside forces working against you. Well, in the scripture context, it very much sort of feels like outside forces working. And maybe it's a metaphor for what's going on internally, but how do you kind of approach it when you're looking at doing some kind of exegesis, and particularly like when you're looking at preaching on the devil passages from the Bible?
Well, I really do. Like when I preach on the temptation, which every year that's one of my favorite things to preach on, really. And I think I like preaching on it because it talks about the devil, and we don't get to do that often. But I take it for what it is. You know, I take it at face value that in that story and maybe in other times and places, there is a personification of evil, and that is the devil. And it's fascinating to me to look at that story because the devil is speaking to Jesus using Jesus's own language. He's tempting Jesus in this really specific Jesus-y way. And I think that that's how, if there's a devil, speaks to us too, is it knows our personality, it knows our ego, and it speaks exactly to that and can sometimes very closely resemble goodness, you know? And like in the book of Revelation, it's the Antichrist, it's not the devil, kind of masquerades as the greatest good. And we see that all the time with like fascism, you know, and oh, here's a system that's going to actually bring about the greatest good. And in fact, it really is the greatest evil. And so I think that preaches, there's something about that. When the devil tempts Jesus in the wilderness, he's inviting Jesus to do very Jesus-y things, but it's just a slight, you know, like you said, Betsy, with the shadow and the light, it's just another side of the same coin. And mm-hmm. to me, it's like that preaches.
Yeah. I always see it as, you know, I'd use a painting to talk about that with my students, and it was this, you know, Jesus in the wilderness, but it's Jesus alone on the rock, you know, and by himself. And I kind of go, because I'll go more internal, because, you know, that having particularly, you know, young people as a part of my main congregation, they're very concrete thinkers. And so the devil is not, you know, they're not being called in the middle of the night by God. You know, the devil isn't coming to them necessarily and speaking, you know, because they'll say, but I haven't heard the voice, you know. But if the voice is in you and of you, like you said, Liz, I think that then they get that. They understand that. And it almost also makes me think about that fabulous Keanu Reeves movie, Little Buddha. And when he is the Buddha meditating and about to reach enlightenment, Mara comes to distract him. So all the evil in the world in this figure of Mara, and so tries to tempt the Buddha with, you know, these young girls who are just having fun and being and are beautiful, and he won't be distracted. And then tries to, you know, an army with flaming arrows that shoot at him, and he doesn't flinch, he doesn't move, he continues to meditate. And like the final temptation is himself reflected in the water. And it's Mara looking exactly like the Buddha, using the Buddha's language, and saying, you know, you can't do this. You're not strong enough to do this, you know. And then he eventually shows his true self and fades away. But I think that is the mirror image ultimate thing, is that it's of us, and it's using the language that gets right to our heart, and right to that part of us that maybe wants to feel better, or whatever it is that we're giving into.
Yeah, I got to tell you though, Betsy, when you started that story and you said Keanu Reeves, I was sure that you were going to say the devil's advocate.
You thought I was going to. Gotcha.
When Al Pacino shows Keanu Reeves.
Do you know, sometimes I fall down these cultural rabbit holes and just disappear for a while. And in the last couple of weeks, I've been doing that with the West Memphis 3 case, which is now kind of passe, but you guys may be familiar. It was in the 90s, three young boys were murdered in this town in Arkansas. Very little evidence, pretty much no evidence. The police, it was a disaster. And they ended up convicting three teenage boys who they accused of being Satanists. And it was right at that time in the 90s where we called it the Satanic Panic, and people were freaking out because, in fact, there probably were no Satanist cults, but culturally we wanted to think it was. And anyways, you sort of explore this whole thing. You see that the whole town just would so rather it be true that three weird kids did this thing rather than to think that one of their own, a parent, you know, a person just like them, could have done this terrible thing in their community. And it's really interesting to me. That's exactly how the devil works. And as it turns out in this story, they then chose to blame fake Satanists. You know, the devil was at work in it, and also managed to distract them from what was really going on in the devil's own name. Culturally, it's just really weird. And it was like a...
I think a source of blame is good. That's a good one. Because I think that this also ties back to scripture. I think that, you know, if you see the serpent as the devil, it's a source of blame, right? For the fall of humanity, for the state that we're in the world. If you see the world as something that needs to be overcome. You know, Jesus being tempted in the wilderness is—it's a place of blame for the things that try to derail you from the spiritual life, from the higher calling of God. It's something, you know, something that gets in your way. And in the Job story, you know, a little harder because it's God that's doing all of the bad stuff here. But you know, at least you have some kind of something that's kind of egging God on. To begin with, and it's a source of blame, and I think you know very much. I think that people, you know, the older I get, the more I come around to this, and you know, it's not to say that there aren't evil people doing evil things in the world. I think that's true. But of course, they absolutely don't see themselves as evil. I don't think anyone in the world sees themselves as evil. Maybe some people do, but I doubt it. I think though that the way that we rationalize evil a lot of times is by figuring out what's to blame, and then that helps our brain kind of cope. I think that the Robin Williams stuff that came out this past week when he died is an example of this. It's not an example of evil necessarily, but it is an example of people needing to find something to blame for something that they don't understand. They don't understand why a man who made them laugh for so long killed himself. And so it's just constantly, you know, is it depression? Is it Parkinson's? Is it drugs? Is it drinking? Like, you know, it's what's the source of blame that we can find to figure this out in our mind? And where I always keep falling back on, scripturally speaking, is the book of Ecclesiastes, which would ultimately tell you it's life, man. That's what it is. It's the world that we live in. And there's your answer, you know? So quit trying to find all the things to blame and accept that this is what it means to be a living being on this world. Sometimes this stuff happens.
Yeah, I was going to bring up the Robin Williams stuff because all those things that you named, what do we call them? Battling your demons, right? Mm. That's what we call them. And that, knowing we were going to talk about this and then having, you know, the terrible tragedy of his loss, And people trying to have conversations about mental illness and addiction, but you're othering it when it's, you know, battling your demons, and as opposed to saying, you know, these are illnesses, these are things that are of me, and made of me, and how do I address them in a way that's concrete, as opposed to kind of demonizing them, see? And it just jumps out, the cliches.
That language just keeps showing up. There's I absolutely, you know, you can go either way on South Park as a source of wisdom in popular culture, but I absolutely love the devil's song from the South Park movie, where, you know, he just gets so much stuff dumped on him, so much blame dumped on him, and all he wants to do is just rise above all of the blame that's being heaped on him during his time in hell. And it's just a constant move to blame and to figure out what the other is and how do we get rid of it, which is really the whole movement or plot point behind any exorcism movie, right? It's never somebody's doing things, you know, themselves. It's always something that we've got to get rid of. we've got to purge.
And how do we take ourselves out of it? You know, I think that we're called as people of faith to dwell in those spaces. And I was disappointed that even, you know, my Facebook feed is overwhelmingly Christian and overwhelmingly Episcopalian, really. It's progressive Christians make up the bulk of it. So that was the slant that I was getting yesterday or, you know, these last few days with Robin Williams. But I was amazed that even these clergy people and people of faith were doing everything they could to be the pastors of Facebook or the pastors of Robin Williams or his family. How many people posted the, you know, 800 number for suicide prevention? You know, I just don't think that's helpful. I think I have a friend whose parent passed away by taking their own life. And in the obituary that she wrote, she said that he succumbed to a long illness. That was the cause of death. He succumbed to a long illness. And it wasn't that she was trying to keep the truth out of the story. It's that she was trying to tell a true story about what really happened. And I wish I had seen more of that in the last few days.
Yeah. A lot of people, the Genie You're Free thing the Academy did has really set off a lot of.
Yeah, it's funny. That's a good point, Liz, because my Facebook page, I felt the same way. I felt, here are a lot of people that are saying a lot of things about themselves, mm-hmm. about people that they know, and very little about Robin Williams. But Robin Williams is the person that they're talking about. Pastoral care to the rescue, which is really what is exciting about the exorcism movies, right? Because it's the priest as the hero, as the action hero, sort of getting in there and you know, taking the green split pea soup in the face. And
we love that.
I'm going over the Exorcist stairs in Georgetown. That's where I'm headed. It takes some time.
But I feel like that's what Facebook was this week. It was a bunch of pastors and spiritually minded people, good people who were like coming to the rescue, man, who saw themselves as the hero that was going to put out the post that was going to save everybody. And it's like, wow, that we see that played out in the movies in a different way, but very much kind of the same narrative of the priest as the hero.
We clergy folk, you know, love to be the experts. And at the end of the day, we're actually experts in very little, if anything at all, you know, unless we're bringing other vocations into something. You know, I have a priest friend who is an expert in Chinese history. I'll take that, you know, but really as pastors and priests, we are not called to be experts. We're called to be leaders, certainly, but also kind of journeying companions. But gosh, we'll take any chance, I think, to jump up in there and say that we're the expert.
I've heard it described before as we are professional lovers of people. Pretty much what it is.
That's great. I love that job description. I'm not always good at it, but I love it.
Which means loving the light and the dark parts of all of you. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, and I think I feel like that's kind of what we're claiming in that baptismal. I keep coming around on the baptismal thing. Yeah, it's kind of hokey to talk about, do you reject Satan and stuff. For one thing, I sort of want to leave it in because it always makes me think of the Godfather in that moment. I always think of Al Pacino standing there and like, do you reject Satan? And then I think some really particularly brutal murder occurs right after that one. But I keep going back and forth on this, like, do you reject Satan and the evils of this world or however it's written up? Obviously, I didn't prepare. I should have broken open a BCC.
Spiritual forces of wickedness that rebel against God.
There you go. That's why we have a canon on the show.
Thank God.
I keep thinking, well, that's kind of a hokey thing. Like, who believes in Satan these days? Like, that's, you know, yeah, get rid of that. But then the other part of me says, no, we do need to take seriously this call to that we're adopting something new. We're adopting some new kind of life. And that means, you know, taking a paring knife to parts of ourselves that we don't necessarily need anymore. You know, if the story of Saint Anthony, right, in Egypt, fighting the demons in the fort or whatever, if that's a metaphor for, you know, what we need to kind of strip away from ourselves in order to live the spiritual life that God calls us to, then it's important for us to remind ourselves of that whenever we see a baptism or whenever we renew our baptism, I think. I'm taking that down the wrong path.
No, when we say that part in the baptismal service, that's, I get chills at those times, you know, because it's countercultural still. And I think it's real. Like you said, Greg, I think that we're adopting a new set of clothes at the very least, at the very most, a whole new being when we become Christians through baptism. And I think evil is real, and you might as well say so.
Well, but I think it's so interesting, you know, that we can talk about all this in our faith life, but then in our pop culture life, we love watching morally ambiguous people in their struggles, from, you know, Tony Soprano to, you know, Breaking Bad to, you
absolutely.
Know,
I mean, you could
Archie
make the
Bunker,
case, but...
you know, forget, like, people stuck in kind of a place of who they are and trying to, and probably making, you know, illegal and terrible choices, but for some in their system of beliefs, it works. But
yeah, I mean, you could make the case that House of Cards is really, it's the devil's story.
Yeah.
It's just that the whole trick of it is, can it make you, to quote the Stones, right? Can it make you feel sympathy for the devil at some, on some kind of level, or at least understand what the devil's motivations are? But it very much is, there's no salvation in this story at all. It's just right down into the muck, and how far into the muck can you go with these characters?
House of Cards is interesting to me on that level, because The Sopranos and Breaking Bad, maybe this is just me, but with both of those shows, for the first many seasons, I was rooting for the bad guy. And I think, you know, that's the point. You love Tony Soprano, even though he's just so despicable, and you love Walter White, and you kind of find yourself rooting for them, and there's always a turning point where you realize they're a psychopath. And then you start rooting against them. On House of Cards with Frank Underwood, from the very first scene when he kills that dog, I'm rooting for everybody else except for him, and he's still the protagonist. And so I wonder what they'll do. Will they flip it, and something will happen in a couple seasons where we start loving him and rooting for him? That would be crazy. I know.
That'd be crazy.
Can't see it. Okay, well, that's a good way to segue us into confessions.
Excellent.
So last time we confessed our favorite guiltiest pleasure. This time, in honor of our devil discussion, we're going to confess, who is your favorite pop culture devil figure? Now, we've already thrown out a few, and that doesn't mean that you can't pick them. I mean, obviously, who doesn't love Al Pacino as the devil and the devil's advocate? I mean, that's... if you had to nail down the devil, that had to be like the ultimate version. Not even close. He eats up so much scenery in that movie. It's insane. But who is your favorite pop culture devil, Betsy?
Well, I've been doing some independent polling, knowing that we were going to talk about this. And it's amazing the number of people that mention Elizabeth Hurley and Bedazzled to me with Brendan Fraser. The lady devils don't get a lot of, there aren't as many roles kind of there, because then it falls into the, you know, the femme fatale and the, you know, tempting woman situation. That's a good one. But I have to say, I mean, I think one of my favorite portrayals of the devil was a short-lived television show called Reaper that was on television. And basically it has Ray Wise, who is, you know, a very tan actor. Look him up on Internet Movie Database.
Ray Wise, the stars of Twin Peaks.
He's so good. And so he portrays Satan as kind of a smooth-talking guy in a suit, and he's often very funny and all those kinds of things. So it's revealed that the main protagonist, Sam, of the show, that his like soul was sold to the devil by his parents or whatever or something when he was a young guy. So now he works at Home Depot, but he also has to go reap souls for the devil and is kind of like his side job, with his kind of, you know, Home Depot friends who were helping him out. But I like the a humorous portrayal of the devil and the wise crack and the thing. And, you know, and I think Ray Wise does a really good job. Really good job. So that's one of my favorites.
Well, Liz, have you thought of one yet?
I have, and it's for no theological reasoning. My favorite pop culture devil is the devil who went down to Georgia in the Charlie Daniels song, because he was looking for a soul to steal, Greg, and he was looking to buy. And the story goes, he came across a young man named Johnny, who was a great fiddle player, and he bet a fiddle of gold against Johnny's soul. Which is,
okay, I think we're verging really close here.
Are we? Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not singing it. We don't have to pay.
There's
the right
no music.
Yet.
There's no music.
But I'll tell you what, it's a great song because Johnny triumphs. Here's the thing, though. The other day I was driving on a long trip across the state of Nebraska, as I often do, and I put in a CD that my high school boyfriend gave me as like a love song mix, and it was great. It was like all these great, like, Dave Matthews Band, totally like late 90s, early 2000s. And then it came across Charlie Daniels, The Devil Went Down to Georgia. On the mixtape to his girlfriend. What does it mean, guys? What does it
I don't
mean?
Know. What moment in the makeout session was that coming on? I don't know about that.
Come on, right?
I'm sorry, we got to take a break from making out. This is my jam.
just hold that thought. I'm going to play the devil down to Georgia.
I need to air fiddle for a moment. Hold the phone. There's an air fiddle coming on.
It was our song. Anyway, that's my favorite pop culture devil, Greg.
Oh, man. So back me up on this, though, right? When in that song, the devil's song is better than Johnny's song, right? Like,
The devil is crazy. When the devil plays, there might be more, like, technical acumen with the devil, but he doesn't have the soul that Johnny has, you know?
Yeah, there's a little too much hayseed for me and Johnny, and I really like the devil part, but, you know, run boy, whatever, you know.
I like the devil part better, I think. Well, my favorite pop culture devil, I went back and forth. I really love the Stone's portrayal of Sympathy for the Devil. I like it, you know, this whole idea of, like, this behind the scenes kind of tempter that just results in the fall of humanity. Especially for the time that they wrote that, you know, in the late 60s, when, like, everything's falling apart and it's like, well, absolutely, you know, here's the ghost in the machine, right? This devil kind of, working through all of these hateful things. It's kind of like, it's like the evil version of We Didn't Start the Fire, you know.
I did start the choir.
I sang that at a middle school assembly, by the way.
But I gotta tell you, my all-time favorite, and this is really weird. It's so weird that we keep coming back to Keanu Reeves. I think that's the thing.
Interesting.
Constantine. So this movie is terrible. The movie Constantine.
It's
a horrible movie. There's nothing great about this movie at all. Except for the devil figure, who's played this time by, Peter, and I don't even know how to pronounce his last name correctly. I always say Stormare, but I know that that's not right. It's like Stormari or something. And Peter Stormare. He's in Fargo. He's in Big Lebowski. You've seen him all over the place. But he plays the devil in this. And there's something about the coolness that he brings. It's not this hot devil, you know, with like pitchfork and red. It's this very cool, subdued thing. And he comes in and he says, he has this great line where he says, "Of all the souls on the earth, yours is the one that I would come for personally," you know, and just like, you know, it's really great moment. I think it's only like a 10-15 minute scene, but he pulls it off so well. And it's menacing and yet charismatic at the same time. It's engaging. And yet you sort of want to run away from it. I think that it's wonderful because it embodies a lot of what we're talking about when we're talking about kind of the way evil works in people's lives. It's a temptation, and yet it's something that you regret. It's something that is appealing in how it looks, and yet at the same time it kind of makes you repulses you at the same time. You know, it's this kind of push pull of that evil kind of has in our lives, and I just think that he pulls that off so well.
It's the pop culture portrayals of the devil are what make you want you want a little more from Jesus than at times. You know, where's the deeper looks into his personality and who he was, you know, and wanting a little bit more meat around this guy who is free of sin and you know, all these wonderful things. And it's then those movies like Last Temptation of Christ and things like that, places where, you know, you're trying to kind of match some of that. And it's always interesting when you have those two things appearing together in film or on television, mm-hmm. have them play off. But go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, recently I rewatched the whole first and only season of that show, The Book of Daniel. Do you remember that when that was
on? Oh, God. Oh, what a
tragedy. I hate it because, you know, it was a weird portrayal of the Episcopal Church that wasn't true. And I watched it again, and as a priest, thought it was pretty dumb, except for the priest's relationship with Jesus is really interesting. Jesus is a like guy who just shows up like in his passenger seat, and they talk. Their conversation is lovely. It seriously was kind of convicting about my own prayer life. Oh. It was a really good portrayal of Jesus. I'll just say that. And the whole thing is available on YouTube. The whole first season.
Really? Huh. But my one devil fact, when I went looking for portrayals of the devil in pop culture that I was unaware of, was that on the show Dallas, on the series finale in 1991, Joel Grey appeared as a character named Adam, who was a devil type figure who showed JR what the world would have been like if JR had never been born. And
it's the opposite of It's a Wonderful Life.
Right, exactly. And then it is revealed in the final moments that he is in fact the devil and has come to make JR destroy himself through his own self-loathing.
Oh, I thought you were going to say it's revealed that JR is the devil. And I was like, really?
What?
That's a twist.
But I'm like, Joel Grey getting interesting work. And I had no idea that series took that turn at the end, Dallas doing that.
I had no idea that series lasted that long. 1991 was the last episode.
Oh, man, that series went a long time.
Wow.
Well, now that we've descended to Dallas talk,
now that we have,
it's probably time to do our go-in pieces.
Yes.
So, what's something that you've got going on in your life, Liz, or that you have been watching or reading or anything like that?
I forgot about this part.
You don't have anything?
No, I'll say I've got lots of things. Well, really, it's been the West Memphis 3 rabbit hole. And it's weird that I became obsessed with this, but maybe not that weird. It's a really interesting story. And I've always been interested in sort of the death row inmate who didn't do it. You know, there's like a whole subgenre of documentaries about that, which I think are interesting. And then the whole exoneration process, and that some people can emerge from that in a beautiful way, and other people are just undone by it. And with the West Memphis 3, the three guys who were convicted got out, and they all seem to be interesting guys and good guys. But one of them, his name is Jason. I forget his last name right now. The interviews I've watched of him, he is just like a delightfully warm, loving, forgiving person. So kind. You can just see it in his face. Not any resentment about what happened to him being in prison for like 18 years or something for a wrongful conviction. Anyway, it's really interesting. It's made me think a lot about that your life can take these twists and turns that you don't expect, and how do you make the most out of it and, you know, manage to keep your integrity in the midst of it. So all the documentaries about that are called whatever. They're on HBO. You can find them on Amazon Prime. They're really good.
Yeah. What about you, Betsy?
Well, being in the school world, I'm kind of in the calm before the storm here. You know, we don't have students back yet, and so it's meetings and things like that. But I had a great conversation today with three colleagues about privilege and about how could we introduce the topic of being reflective about your own privilege or times when you haven't felt privilege in a kind of safe chapel identity kind of thing. You know, how to share stories about that. They did a wonderful chapel last year about with coming out stories. And so people submitted their stories, and then the stories were read by other people. They were all anonymous. And it was this really powerful evensong with these stories. And so kind of how could we talk about privilege in a community where many people, many students, you know, financially privileged, but that there's also other facets of that. You know, there's the socioeconomic pieces, but then there's privilege that comes from race and privilege that comes from gender and privilege that comes from, you know, a whole host of things. So how do you kind of go at a sticky wicket in your community in a really lovely pastoral way that then everybody can kind of feel that they can share and share where they are in that journey of identity and figuring themselves out. And so I'm excited about that, because, you know, the Bible goes after socioeconomics, you know, all the time.
Yeah.
And so you always wonder in that idea of when you are preaching in the empire, what are you saying to the empire as opposed to standing outside of it and talking to it? So I think that's going to be really interesting. I'm looking forward to that. And we're going to try to carry pieces of it throughout the year that, you know, we can kind of add to that storytelling space. So I think it'll be cool. I'm looking forward to it.
What
about you, Greg?
Well, yeah. Sleepless
what
nights.
What have you been up to?
You have nothing new happening in your life.
No, nothing at all. Just bringing you know, human life into the world.
All of that.
Right.
You know, another soul for us to eventually save.
Right, to win from Satan's bounty.
You know, honestly, though, you know, you hang out with a 2-week-old long enough, and you really start to think to yourself, I think Augustine had a point. I think these things are just fallen creatures who are just me all the time.
Good point.
These things need salvation.
That could be the lack of sleep talking.
Second child, 2 weeks old. As a matter of fact, she's about to cry, I'm sure, sometime soon. So I'll be running and changing a diaper. And it's funny, it's muscle memory. All those things that we did with the first one, it's all coming back. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. They're not that heavy at first. And the diapers look a little bit different originally. Yeah, stuff like that. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Yeah, that's been my major piece. And then my second piece, I guess, that just starting another year of Sunday school and youth groups and stuff like that, as we get into September. And it's really amazing. I always tell people that I have the best job because it's different every single year. Like this, and the people that I've been working with, the year before, they've all aged a year, and a year's age difference, with a child or a youth, member is like a world difference. It's like 20 years difference in adult years or something. So so I'm looking forward to getting to know my kids again this year, which is always a lot of fun. So and that's it. You know what? We're just going to do outros this time. So Liz, tell us who you are and where you're working.
My name's Liz Easton, and I'm an Episcopal priest and the canon to the ordinary in the Diocese of Nebraska, and I live in Omaha.
Betsy.
I'm Betsy Carmody Gonzalez, and I am a priest and school chaplain serving at a boarding school in Northern Virginia.
And I am Greg Knight. I'm the director of children and youth ministries at Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida. This has been Popping Collars. Thank you, guys.
That's right. Keep those collars pop.
We'll see you next time.